Welcome to this week's podcast for Friday, 23rd November, with me, Ian Welsh. Coming up is our usual news digest and details of what we're up to at Innovation Forum. Plus, when I was in Amsterdam last month, I interviewed Suzanne Westlake from UK retailer Ocado about what her business is doing on plastic waste. And at Innovation Forum's Landscapes Conference in London a couple of weeks ago, I caught up with Cotton Connect's Alison Ward. Before that, though, our weekly review of some of what's happening in business and sustainability. It's been hard to miss the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil's vote to tighten its principles and criteria at its annual General Assembly held in Malaysia. The headline is that the revised standards prohibit any member company from clearing forest of any type for palm plantations. Previously, clearance of secondary forest, and for some peat forests, was within the rules, but now no planting on peat of any depth is allowed. Human rights issues are also addressed in the revisions. More attention to lands with high carbon stock value will also be required. The RSPO had come under increasing pressure to take a stronger lead on developing more sustainable palm oil, not least from growing consumer awareness about where the palm oil in the products they use comes from. And many companies already have strong commitments, of course, on how and where their palm oil is sourced. And activists have focused significant attention on enforcement in the past. And how the RSPO enforces its new principles and criteria will no doubt be subject to significant scrutiny. Now, we'll have our own analysis of the potential implications of the new RSPO P's and C's in the Innovation Forum newsletter in the coming week or two, so do keep an eye out for that. The use of palm oil and oil from soy as fuel has become increasingly controversial due to the relatively high emissions from such biofuels, and the European Parliament has voted to approve a new set of cleaner energy laws through to 2030, which include a further boost in the use of renewables combined with cutting biofuel from palm and soy. The EU has a goal of increasing energy efficiency across its members by 32.5% compared to a 2016 baseline. Each member state will be required to prepare a 10-year energy and climate plan, including targets and policy detail. And the first of these is due by the end of next year, with a review every decade thereafter. The proportion of soybean and palm oil in fuels is not to grow above each EU state's 2019 consumption and then decline from 2023 onwards, reaching zero by 2030. Palm oil in particular has been a controversial ingredient in fuels, with some research suggesting its life cycle emissions are in fact several times those of fossil fuels. In some respects, the EU is playing catch-up to initiatives being taken, apparently, in member states. A new French national deforest strategy, for example, indicates an intention to stop importing palm oil, wood products, soy, beef and other products linked to deforestation also by 2030. The intention of the French Environment Ministry is to use trade to decouple economic development from unsustainable agricultural practices, particularly forest clearance. Imports into the EU of agricultural products from tropical forested regions account for more than one-third of global deforestation, according to the French Environment Ministry. Elsewhere this week, a group of leading fashion retailers has pledged to work together and with enforcement bodies in the UK to help eradicate modern slavery from the textile sector. Signatories to the Apparel and General Merchandise Public and Private Protocol are committed to strive to work to identify and eliminate exploitation by raising awareness to protect those most vulnerable in supply chains. Government bodies and industry associations will work with the companies in the protocol to achieve its aims. Do check out Innovation Forum's 2019 conference programme and get the dates in your diary. The exciting roster will include new events on the future for food, apparel supply chains, modern slavery, climate change and the developing bioeconomy. More information, including where and when these events will be held in Europe and North America, is available in this week's newsletter. Interview time now. At Innovation Forum's Business and Plastic Waste Conference in Amsterdam last month, I sat down with Suzanne Westlake, Head of Corporate Responsibility and Corporate Affairs at online retailer Ocado. So we've just been talking about the unintended consequences of dropping plastics. From your perspective, what are the practicalities of removing all plastic from packaging?
I think, first up, all plastic's not bad. I think unnecessary plastic is bad in inverted commas, but plastic's a phenomenal material and it's almost become a victim of its own success. So I think we shouldn't demonise plastic in its entirety. But as an industry, we should be working towards reducing and eliminating unnecessary plastic, but recognising plastic has a role to play in not increasing food waste.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think there's an educational role we have to really enhance? Because plastic has been demonised, there's no doubt about it, and it's something that the public have really cottoned on to. Do you think that there's a general consensus that maybe people have forgotten why we had plastic there in the first place?
I think they have. As I said before, you know, plastic's a phenomenal material. It withstands heat and frozen and a whole multitude of things. We need to make sure it's used for what it's intended. So I think with respect to food waste, it can protect the food in transit. It can keep it safe for consumption. It can be frozen. It can be straight in the oven. It can go in the microwave. It really does have an incredible purpose. I think we need to not lose sight of that. And I think as an industry, as NGOs, as the media in particular, we've got a great role we can play with educating customers now. And that the sort of the helpful did you knows, I think, are always useful for the public. Many of us in this field struggle to keep up with some of this knowledge and, mm-hmm. and the fast moving content, let alone the person on the street who, quite frankly, just wants to try and do their best.
What are the specific areas where plastics is the only practical material then?
I think for us, we've got rid of polystyrene and, or we will have by Christmas, we've got rid of polystyrene and PVC because there are viable alternatives to both materials. And both materials are identified in the UK Plastic Pact as something that can be replaced with an alternative. The same then with some of the other materials like the black plastics, which for Ocado will have gone by spring. There are viable alternatives. But we need to not forget with things like the flexibles, you know, there's steak that needs to be heat sealed in order to preserve its life. Some of the plastics with things like tomato pots and growing herbs are very easily able to be replaced with one material and another. That's what we've done and that's what many of our peers are also looking to do.
Is it your height of your concern that if you don't approach this sensibly, you could suddenly have a significant food waste problem on your hands?
Absolutely. And that's something I'm passionate to avoid. I mean, we've worked really, really hard to get our food waste to what I believe is the lowest in the industry. We're 0.02%, which is a figure I'm very, very proud of. And I think it would be a tragedy for everybody trying their very best with plastics to inadvertently then push up food waste. When actually, I think if we do this across the industry in a collaborative, measured approach that's done properly, we can actually achieve a reduction in plastic without having any impact on food waste.
Is it the films that are the real plastic products that are currently irreplaceable?
Films are the one area that's causing industry, from everybody from government and RAP and everybody, a challenge on how we address it. So I don't think there is a magic bullet for that. I think we can all work together to try and find an alternative. But I don't think any plastic should be demonised. I think we need to collectively try and work out how we find a plastic that's not plastic.
Indeed. What does best practice collaboration look like in this area then? I mean, you've got lots of different players in different parts of the value chain around plastics. What's the best way for them all to come together?
I would hope that that's the sentiment of the UK Plastic Pact. For me, it seems to be the first time ever that everybody from manufacturing to retail to councils, NGOs, government, recycling facilities, waste providers have all got together from the whole end-to-end of the chain to try and address this holistically. So I think if we can get to the point where we're producing a material that is made of a reduced number of materials, that retailers can then differentiate with what goes in said material, and consumers can recycle it with ease. We've not made it any more complex for the councils and for the recycling folk. And then hopefully it can all the way come back around and be reused again, like the sort of immortal milk bottle, which mm-hmm. seems to be utopia in recycling land.
So at Ocado, you deliver groceries to your customers. You don't have any stores.
Nope.
100% delivery. So there must be an opportunity then for you to take back some of the waste. How much of that would be the route you want to go down, or how much is it best to let curbside recycling do the job?
We've been recycling plastic bags for over a decade, and we're very good at that. We get back at least 87% of all the bags that go out. We're always looking at alternatives as to what we might be able to do with other plastics, but there's a fine line between not contaminating the stream we currently have, which allows us to take back bags, not just our own, anybody's bags, and have those recycled in the UK and turn back into plastic bags without disrupting that, whilst at the same time not taking away plastics that have value out of the recycling systems and centres. Mm-hmm. Where as a society this is all going wrong is reducing the value of some of this plastic. As the public and as retailers, we need to start reminding people that this is good quality material and it actually has a value and it's worth something.
Yeah, that is the fundamental point from a consumer perspective, is that they've never seen it as something of value. It's simply something that's
a throwaway culture.
Yeah. Absolutely. When you are developing new packaging then, how conscious are you of making the job of the waste management industry more challenging and not less? If you, for example, introducing a whole load of new types of materials.
I would really hope we weren't making their life any more difficult, because I think they've got quite a difficult challenge as it is. We've certainly tried to go down the route of the regular or the understood streams that are recycled content wherever possible. We've certainly stipulated in all new products and the Ocado own brand going forward that we've eliminated the PVC and the polystyrene and the black plastic. So again, that will be coming out of the stream that we are putting into society. And I wouldn't be looking for us to introduce anything obscure, not only because I think it makes the waste providers' jobs even more difficult, but also the public and the consumers, they just don't know what to do with it. They're struggling as it is. Mm-hmm. We all have an array of bins at the end of our drive. I think we need to keep this as simple as we possibly can without making it any more complex.
And then what is Ocado's role to help its customers do that then?
I think we can continue to work on the own brand range that we have, which we've already made some progress, like I explained. So I think where we possibly can do that ourselves, we have. What we need to then be doing is educating the customers. We're building a landing page like we've done for food waste, which is a series of information that's useful for consumers in a very simplistic, customer-friendly language that allows them to understand what they can recycle, what the content is in their materials that they're finding in their shop, and what they can do with it, what goes in what bin, what does things like widely recycled mean. We're doing a lot of that in collaboration with RAP, and hopefully there's just some handy hints and tips to make some of this simple. I know I keep saying simple, but I think that's the nub of a lot of this, is let's demystify the complexity and just boil it down to basics to keep it all nice and easy.
You're right. Talking about keeping things simple has really come out so far here at the conference. Looking forward, what are the kind of new business models that you think can really help cut plastic waste in the future? The kind of things that we haven't thought of yet. What are you expecting to see?
I'd like to see innovation. I think I'd like to see packaging being cleverly designed. I think let's take the lid off what's possible and let's explore. I'm not sure I have all the answers. I, to be honest, Ian, I don't think anybody's got all the answers. I think if there was a magic pill, we'd have all had it by now. I think we need to design in simplicity and design out complexity. And not forget that retail is one piece of the puzzle rather than the answer to everybody's prayers. We all need to try and work it through the system.
Sure. Well, there's that, it feels like business models are having to change to take account of
evolution.
Yeah, of evolving business models to take account of plastic pollution. But thank you very much for now, Suzanne from Ocado.
You're welcome.
And in London a couple of weeks ago, I caught up with a regular on the Innovation Forum podcast, Alison Ward, CEO of Cotton Connect. We've just been talking about your work with Primark and developing resilience in smaller supply chains. How do your projects with Primark and your other partners, how do they really work to develop resilience in smaller supply chains?
I think really the first element is that we've created traceable supply chains. Primark actually know where their cotton is coming from, and we've just heard this 4.4 million pairs of pyjamas have taken cotton from our project in Gujarat. So there's now an accountability and an understanding of what's going on at a ground level. From having that sight of the supply chain, we can then really work with those communities. And I think what's quite exciting about some of the work we're doing is that it's not just the cotton, it's not just the agronomic piece, that we've built in elements about rights and life skills for women. We've looked at the winter crop within India. We've looked at the intercrop, so spices that are intercropped already with cotton. So this really becomes a package that pulls together across the community and looks not at farmers as cotton farmers, but as members of a rural community.
Obviously, for Primark, it's quite a small proportion of their cotton comes from your project, but it's one that they plan to develop and roll out as they move towards their goal of 100% sustainable cotton in their supply chains. How much do you see the role of gender empowerment in helping brands like Primark develop more sustainable supply chains?
Yeah, and I think women in cotton is a real theme that we've been looking at in Cotton Connect over the past 5 years. And we started off in 2014 with only 1,500 women in our programmes, and now we have 50,000 women in our programmes across different countries. We talk about how important women are in agriculture and the amazing impact that you can have by training women, both in terms of the income of the farm, harm itself, in the confidence in women, in the health of the family. So for me, it has been a cornerstone of what we've done at Cotton Connect. And it is amazing to see the results in terms of both prosperity, but also really building women leaders for the future in rural communities.
Let's talk about that a bit more. How are these communities being developed? Because something that's come out over the last couple of days here is the importance of building sustainable communities. It's not just about the farmer, male or female, it's about the community around that farmer. How do you develop a sustainable community? How is your work to help them to develop that?
I mean, one of our approaches is we work with a local group, a local NGO who's really trusted in the region, and we do that consistently. Obviously, we're working in Gujarat, and the language is Gujarati, but even within Gujarat, there are dialects. So it's really important that we are sensitive to local community needs. So although we've got a core agronomic program, we then adapt it depending on what's going on in that community. And it's the same as when you look at women and training women, sort of changing social norms. So you have to be quite sensitive and thoughtful about how you do that. We're a bottoms up, feet on the ground organisation, and that's deliberate, that we really grow up from the bottom.
How do you approach the cultural sensitivities? You just raised them just now. How do you tackle them so that you take account of what is culturally the norm, but then it develop that? What kind of reassurance do you have to give to the communities that you're not there to kind of tell them what to do, but in fact, it's you're there to help them become more resilient?
Yeah, absolutely. Really, a lot of it is the farmers begin to see changes. So they're seeing a reduction in their pesticide and fertiliser use. So I met a woman recently who'd saved £700 a year just by applying her fertiliser correctly on her farm. Now, that's just a saving she'd made, let alone the fact that her yield will increase, her water consumption will increase, and she's getting new skills. So I think once farmers begin to see those kind of numbers, that you get that confidence. When you're trusted, you can begin to talk about other more difficult topics. And we tend to start with nutrition and health, because obviously women are allowed to go and learn about nutrition and health by the men in the family. And then we begin to talk about rights and entrepreneurship. But it's really trust. And we've just heard in our session, it's 2013 when we started working with Primark. 2018, we've got pyjamas in store. It does take that length of time to build community confidence, business confidence, and then the right framework to really make it work.
In all these matters, we always talk about how we can scale things up and the kind of transformation rather than the incremental change. Is it peer-to-peer learning that can really transform this sort of approach? You train a certain number of women and people in a community, and then they go out and then train themselves a number, and then your numbers can explode that are really have improvements and more resilience in their activities.
I mean, there is the cascade within communities, definitely. I do also think there's around 20% of the world's cotton is now classed as sustainable. I mean, there's still a whole lot that isn't, and a number of companies that perhaps still aren't involved to the level they should be. So I do think that there's a need to continue as a sector to be accountable for this as well. But you need to operate at both levels, don't you? Both at this sort of the business accountability, but then how do you really scale up at a farm level as well?
It's more complicated than that then, isn't it? It's just you've got to do every different approach as a place, and it's bringing them all together. Someone asked a question in the session, you know, what are the hurdles of getting to 100% sustainability? Well, for you, you've been working in the sector for some time. You've got other commodity experience as well. What are the hurdles to getting to 100% sustainable, in inverted commas, commodities?
One is time. And I think that our average farmer training programme is 3 years. And that's the time between, I think, the first year the farmers apply some of the techniques that they learn. But if you can imagine you've been farming for 20 years in a certain way, and then you're told to farm in a different way. So perhaps you've been flood irrigating and you're now told to alternate furrow irrigate or invest in some drip irrigation. You're probably not going to put it over your whole land in the first year. I think there's a time frame against this. And then I think it's really, and we've been talking about the business case with Primark today, how do we make this work? The Primark pyjama is £6. So there's no increase in terms of the product cost. And we've been able to maintain the cotton at the market rate through our market linkages programme. So there is a need, I think, to really demonstrate that this can work for business. Yes, there's business investment, but there's not this huge increase in terms of cost of goods.
But back to your point about reassurance for the farmers, how do you reassure a farming community that has been doing things a particular way that your way is better?
I mean, there's some tried and tested techniques, which I'm sure other commodities will know about. There's lead farmers, so you tend to look for a lead farmer who's the innovative farmer. We do demo plots. You can take farmers to visit other farms that have been successful. So there's quite a few techniques to encourage farmers. I mean, with cotton, obviously, it's planted April, May and harvest in November. So you can see quite quickly the difference between two sides of the field as well. So quite often you'll have a side, which is where we've intervened and the plants are healthier and bigger, and then the other side, which hasn't. And instantly the farmer can see the difference, actually.
It's still a bit of a leap of faith, though, isn't it, when this crop is so much of the income for that particular farmer.
Sure.
Just to tie things together then, how does your work with Primark and other partners, how do you help to ensure that the children of today's farmers want to be farmers on their own in the future, women and men?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a question for agriculture across the world. Certainly we see that for youth in farming communities, the use of technology makes it more appealing. So we've been doing some work with training through mobile technology. So we've done some pilots on that. And certainly, I mean, all of the mobile technology is young farmers. And I think that's going to be quite key to the future, because it's quite exciting to get the message on your phone, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And then we've also been looking at creating sort of micro businesses at a farm level, whether it be for women or for men. And some of it is about them creating their own fertilisers, so organic fertilisers, and selling it, for example.
Sure.
So really ways that actually you're beginning to show that farming is modern, is appealing in terms of money. And they're really seeing in our programmes that incomes are really increasing. So they're seeing actually, oh, this isn't such a bad life after all, that we can really create a thriving business from there.
This is the kind of the crux of the whole issue. We really have to have communities that are thriving, that are attractive to the next generation. Otherwise, existing supply chains simply won't be there in a generation's time. So that's the big challenge. Alison Ward, CEO of Cotton Connect, thanks very much, and thanks for your continued support.
Thank you.
Don't forget to check out Innovation Forum's 2019 events calendar and get those dates in your diary. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh. I'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye.